Today, should I say that I'm in Overland Park, and it's so great to join you via video. I'm really looking forward to meeting all of you. I spent 4 days in Overland Park in the past, and I know I met many of you. I just probably can't remember all your names, but I really want to work on that very hard because I think it's important.
That's Rabbi Javier Katapan introducing himself by video to his new congregation, Beth Torah, in Overland Park. He was living in Indiana at the time, but you may hear in his voice that he originally comes from a little further away. Rabbi Katapan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. How long have you been in Kansas City?
I've been in Kansas City since the middle of June. The position started on July the 1st.
So are you liking it so far? Have you learned all those names yet?
You know, I have learned a lot of the names, and we've been enjoying living in the area. I always say that I actually get to know a lot about Overland Park, but I really haven't seen Kansas City yet, so I'm looking forward to that. And
yeah, we'll have to fix that.
Thanks.
So when you say we, who is we?
So my husband and I moved here from Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I served the congregation there for about 6 years.
Is being an openly gay rabbi in 2016, I mean, is that a comfortable position?
It is in our reform movement and probably in the conservative movement as well. So it is, you know, when I came to rabbinical school, to the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, it was not even an issue when I was interviewing or anything like that. So,
well, you grew up in Argentina and in an unusual kind of background for a rabbi. You actually didn't grow up Jewish. Tell me about your childhood.
Correct. So my family it came originally from Italy. So they immigrated to Argentina in the 20s and they were Catholic. And when I was 16, I was interested in some things about religion. I was in high school. I was writing a paper about religion. And I wasn't quite happy with my inherited religion.
But can I talk to you a little bit more about that experience before we get into a conversion experience? Because so you grew up Catholic. Was your family very observant Catholic?
Actually, not. I was actually the observant one.
You were kind of drawn to religion.
I was drawn to religion, I would say, yes. So I was interested in religion, and I would probably have considered the priesthood as a choice. So that was something that I was always attracted to.
When you talk about being into religion, what was it that you were feeling? What was it that drew you to religion even as a boy?
Right. I think it was mostly because I was interested in the learning part. I was interested in the ritual, in the being in community with other people, and the singing part. Because in our Catholic church in Argentina, there was a lot of singing. It was done with guitars. It was sort of a third world kind of theology, liberation theology. And it was very inclusive. And I always went to the youth group services. And everything was very, participatory. And I was drawn to that.
When you say that by the time you were 16, you weren't happy with your inherited religion, what were you unhappy about? It sounds like a good experience from everything
you've said
so far.
I think it's because of my interest in philosophy and things like that, that I was starting to read a little bit more. And from a philosophical point of view, Christianity didn't fulfill my needs and understandings. I think I reached the conclusion that the believing one God kind of in a simple way without any other, saints and all that, that was part of our tradition in Argentina, seemed more simpler to me. And it was interesting because I was not, I had a very good experience in general, and it was really my decision to move away from the Catholic Church.
Can you explain a little bit more what you were going through philosophically? Because I think a lot of people at around 16 start questioning all kinds of things that they've inherited. philosophically, whether it's their religion or like that their parents eat meat or, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I understand.
That's just
an age
where you start to do that.
And I think it's fair to say that I was in that place as well. I wasn't really, I guess my rebellion was more intellectual. And I had a group of friends in high school, and we read philosophy. We read Balzac, and we read Simone de Beauvoir.
You guys knew how to party.
So, yeah, it was a very unique, I think, experience with them. We studied English together and French. So we did all those things as a very, I think, sort of intellectual kind of group. And our fun part was to go on to Buenos Aires on Saturday night to the secondhand bookstores that we have them in one of the streets and browse for hours and just find things. And it was just like, that was what we did for fun.
I would have liked to do that with you. That sounds like a lot of fun. So at 16, you're starting to go through all this philosophical stirring, and it takes you, it sounds like, toward Judaism. What was your familiarity with Jewish people or Jewish communities growing up Catholic in Argentina?
Right. Argentina, of all the Latin American cities, Buenos Aires in particular, has always had the largest Jewish community. So there were about 500,000 Jews in the city. And I had neighbors and I had classmates in high school who were Jewish. And when I was 15, some of them invited me over to Kol Nidre service, like Yom Kippur and the Day of Atonement. And another time they invited us to a Seder.
I need to jump in here because I am imagining, okay, Kol Nidre is, it's a moment in the year when Jewish people, I mean, no matter how powerful or positive the experience is of repenting for your wrongdoings over the course of the past year and trying to set yourself on a path toward a better self and a better year ahead. And it's not what I'd call a fun holiday. I mean, there's pounding yourself on the chest with your fist. There's fasting, just really not super fun, you know? And so you, as a visitor from outside this faith, it's surprising to me that that would be a really alluring introduction.
But it was. And I think that down the road, I kept thinking about these questions, because had I gone to a different congregation with a different group of people, I don't think that I would have made a decision to continue my search into Judaism. Because I think it was really that group of people in my local synagogue who were very open, very passionate about their traditions, and they were really welcoming. And this family in particular, and I'm still friends with them, they are actually twins, and we continue our friendship throughout the years. They were really so open and welcoming.
What did you witness in them or experience from them? I mean, can you remember a specific moment that just was really powerful for you?
I do. Actually, we got there a little late, so I think we missed Kol Nidre, the prayer, altogether. So by the time we got there, they were in the middle of the standing prayer of the Amida, and it was silence, and we were all facing towards Jerusalem.
Yeah, you face toward Jerusalem, and you bow.
And you bow. But at that part, there was silence. They were finishing. And out of the silence, they start singing a song called Oseh Shalom. And it was just so powerful for me to be there and hear people singing a cappella and singing a song together. I just thought it was, this is the place I want to be.
How was it different from the singing you had done in the Catholic Church?
I think that I was always interested in languages since I was a child. And this was in Hebrew. And I think that added that maybe extra aspect of being maybe exotic, and that attracted me. Maybe, you know, if our Catholic Church would have kept Latin, maybe it would have been different for me. But I think I thought that was pretty neat that an ancient language were still being used and that people find it meaningful.
So how did you take these personal experiences and turn them into a really serious exploration of not only a new faith, but ultimately a profession?
So I first met with the person who was leading services in this congregation. His name is Daniel Mintzer. And he invited me to come, this was in August, and sing in their youth choir. Now, mind you, I wasn't even Jewish and had never been to anything, but that's the kind of person he was, and he is, and we're still in touch. So he invited me to come and just come and start experiencing that. And he's an architect, but he really is a person who showed me that this is a career path for me, in addition to being a religion that I wanted to be part of. So he was really a mentor in the best sense of the way, of the word, and someone who really showed me. And I wasn't actually Jewish until I turned 21. That was a legal thing in Argentina. So he let me lead services, give a little sermon or Dvar Torah to explain the Torah portion of the week, little things, and really was life-changing for me. He actually did this for other people as well, other youth, but it didn't take with them.
How did your family respond to all of this?
You know, going back to your question about the rebellion, my mother, may she rest in peace, thought that this is something that shall pass, that this is something that...
Her Catholic son's interest in
probably
Judaism.
Exactly. And my father was very supportive from the very beginning. He thought that it was great that I was learning Hebrew and I was learning something different, that he had no problem. My mother actually, after a few months, she was worried where I was going. So with a neighbor who was Jewish, she went and came to services and met with some of the people there. And that assured her that this wasn't any kind of a cult or anything, that it was going to take me away from family and for, you know, I said, you know, this is actually making me a better person, a better son. And I think she understood.
Can you flesh out that argument a little bit more, how it was making you a better son?
Well, I think because I was learning and I was being part of a community and I was doing what I wanted to do. And it made me, in a sense, happier to be part of a community. It wasn't the community that she might have, you know, liked me to do, but it was something that she understood. And the road, my father, it's interesting that he actually has to explain why he's not Jewish. You know, his son is a rabbi, and why, you know, why are you not Jewish? And so he had to explain that later on. So,
do you, it sounds like there was a huge Jewish community around you throughout your life as a child in Buenos Aires. Was there also visible or prevalent anti-Semitism?
When I was growing up, this was in the 70s, the problems in Argentina had to do mostly with the military dictatorship. So there were hard times for everybody. And there were, from time to time, anti-Semitic incidents, maybe swastika painted on a cemetery or something like that. But by the time I came of age, Argentina went through a process of democratization in 1983-84. So we really experienced a reopening of the country. And that also meant that if there was any anti-Semitism, it was not anymore supported by the government, or you know, the military government was particularly virulent against what they considered left-leaning people. And if they were Jewish, it was worse for them.
During the military
dictatorship. So
afterwards, the separation of the government from that kind of sentiment, it sounds like, did make a difference?
It did make a difference. And I think that I had a more positive experience of that. However, in Argentina and in anywhere around the world, when you become Jewish, you have to, or when, you know, I now teach people who are, you know, on the conversion process. And that's something that we need to talk about as well, because that is a reality of being Jewish all over the world. So that you can always face something like that. And, you know, are you ready to take that as well as, you know, all the other things that you find interesting and fascinating?
Of course, I want to get back to your study, sure. But it's hard to have this particular conversation without acknowledging some disturbing local news of vandalism at the central branch of the Kansas City Public Library, including swastikas, the N-word, and an accompanying political message about President-elect Trump. They have the vandal on surveillance, and it's already being cleaned up. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people in the Jewish community are probably hurting at least a little bit seeing this news. How is it affecting you?
I think it's a reminder that some of the underlying anti-Semitism in some groups is still there. So it is really an opportunity for us to remember that we should not let our guard down. And then when we talk about teaching tolerance and teaching about the Holocaust and teaching about the different ways in which people express their religious beliefs, there's still a lot of work to be done there. And we're blessed to live in this country. I'm a U.S. citizen, and I'm very happy to be here, and it's been wonderful. But not everything is all right all the time. And there's an opportunity, I think, to condemn what happened, to come together and to show all the people who are actually really working together in the city, in the area, in the metro area.
As someone who has had a part of your life where you were not Jewish and now a part of your life where you're not only Jewish, but visibly, professionally Jewish, do you have any special insights into, how tolerance can happen, how the gap between different people's experiences and understandings of what it means to be Jewish or what it means to just be part of maybe what's seen as an outside group? What can you...
You know, I thought about this when I was in rabbinical school. We took a class called pastoral care, basically education. And one of the questions that we had as students was, how could we empathize with people if we haven't gone through that experience? And I think that I really learned empathy from my mother. She was someone who... She was kind of the nurse of the neighborhood. If somebody will stay overnight at a hospital, she will stay with them. If somebody had something going on in their lives at home, or if they were sick, she will go and help them. And I saw that growing up. And despite the fact that she never said anything sort of like ethical treatise or any book that she wrote about this, she really lived this way. And I think that I picked up on that very early on.
So just in the context of seeing something, sure, like a swastika, mm-hmm, how do you think, do you think there's a healthy response to something like this?
I think there's a healthy response in that we need to find more common ground with other people in the nation in general and as a Jewish community. When I lived in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I was very active with our downtown clergy group, and we had a great variety of people in there. And we tried to do things that will bring people together, for instance, like a Thanksgiving interfaith service where everybody was able to learn about each other, but at the same time being able to express their own identity. So, and I think that it's important that we build connections before these things happen. So we had a case in Fort Wayne where our cemetery was vandalized, our Jewish cemetery. But we had those relationships with the community, so they rallied behind us and really taught us that we have to be together all the time, not just when these things happen. So I think that there is maybe a wake-up call always when the things happen, but then we need to keep working on this year round, because these things may happen again to the Jewish community, to other communities.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about your experience with bigotry, whether it be anti-Semitism upon becoming Jewish or any other form of bigotry?
I've been really blessed in this regard. I haven't had any personal experiences with being, you know, suffering anti-Semitism or any, you know, anti-gay things.
Just nothing at all?
Just nothing. I mean, it's that part, I maybe not as interesting, because I think that it's been really a time when the time I grew up in Argentina and then the time I came to America, some of the things, they didn't touch me directly.
Well, KCUR Central Standard has to take a short break. When we return, we'll pick back up where we left off to hear more of Rabbi Javier Catapan's journey from a Catholic childhood in Argentina to his post as Jewish clergy in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman here on KCUR Central Standard with Rabbi Javier Catapan. He's with Beth Torah, a congregation in Overland Park, and he's been in town since July. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And he was just telling us about his journey as into the Jewish faith through a Catholic upbringing in Buenos Aires. But we haven't talked yet, Rabbi, about your journey from Argentina to the United States.
So when I was in Argentina, in this congregation that was so welcoming, when I was in my last year of high school, they were having a class in Hebrew, so I took it. But then in the middle of the year, the class went away, and they were studying the same book at a rabbinical seminary we have in Buenos Aires, a conservative rabbinical seminary. So I went.
To keep learning Hebrew.
To keep learning Hebrew. And when I went, it was about an hour commute in the train and the bus. They said, well, you're coming all the way. Why don't you take other classes? And we explained to them with a friend that I had from my home congregation, well, he's not really Jewish. But so that's okay. He can take these classes anyway. So my second semester of high school, I was studying at the rabbinical seminary. And I studied there through college in Argentina. That seminary requires that you take a college class and have a degree before you become a rabbi. So I went and studied philosophy at the university. And then in the evenings, I went to the seminary where all the classes are taught in Hebrew. So from age 17 to age 19, I took intensive Hebrew so that I was able to take then classes in Hebrew.
That's very full-time. I mean, studying philosophy all day. And then, I mean, I'm guessing you had some reading and such that you were supposed to do at night for your philosophical studies, but taking a break to take a long commute, go study Hebrew and take classes in Hebrew. What was the content of those classes? Your commitment to it seems pretty remarkable to me.
So our classes were, I took Hebrew, I took Talmud and Bible and Jewish education, and Jewish language, I mean, Hebrew language, how to teach it, how to do all the things. So it was really a rabbinical seminary, pre-rabbinical kind of classes where you would learn how to become a Hebrew teacher for the very extensive network of Jewish day schools that Argentina had in those days. So then when you finish that, you can choose to enter the rabbinical school itself. And so when I was 24, I decided that I wanted to come to rabbinical school in the U.S. when I was 23, 24. And I finished that first part of the training. And in those days, the conservative movement did not ordain openly gay rabbis. So that wasn't a choice for me in Argentina. But at the same time, that was pretty full-time, but I really wanted a full-time Jewish institution. I didn't want to go to university during the day and four times a week from about 6 to, you know, 10:30 in the evening, go to Hebrew school. I thought it would be so cool to be in a place like I saw in the movies where everybody's in school and they have a dorm and all that. We don't have that in Argentina. So, and I thought that I could accomplish so much more by doing that. So I reached out to the rabbinical seminaries here in the States, and the Hebrew Union College was the best match. So
where is that?
It's in Cincinnati, Ohio.
What did you know of Cincinnati before?
So I thought it was something like a prison place, Sin.
Oh.
But it's not. But it was not, apparently. So I knew nothing about it. So I came to Cincinnati. I thought it was a beautiful place. It had little hills.
Better than coming to prison.
Much better. And also, I always liked the mountains and the hills, and Buenos Aires is very flat. So when I landed in northern Kentucky where the airport is, I thought, oh, this is beautiful. I can live here.
By the time, I mean, you talked about that the conservative movement didn't allow, didn't ordain gay rabbis at that time. I don't know, do they ordain gay rabbis
they
now?
They do now, yes.
And is it, I mean, converting to Judaism is not like the typical path. Has there been openness around that for you within the...
So, strangely enough, though, I was not the only one in my class who had converted to Judaism. There were a few others. So I learned that although it sounds unique, it wasn't as unique. You're not supposed to, when you are with in the Jewish people, you're not supposed to ask someone if they converted or not. And so, well, you know, everybody's equally Jewish. So we didn't talk about that until later on. And so it was interesting that people have had one of their parents Jewish and the other parent wasn't Jewish. And if in the Jewish traditional sense, if your mother is not Jewish, some denominations may not consider you fully Jewish. So we had a lot of them in, you know, my classmates and friends. So it was a much more diverse group of people that I would have imagined. In Argentina, it was quite different. So I was the only one. But when I came to the Hebrew College, it was different.
I have so much more that I want to talk to you about, but Rabbi Javier Catapan of Congregation Beth Torah, our time is up. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we'll just have to talk again some other time.
Thank you. It was wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a rebroadcast of our conversation about white studies, which is probably not quite what it sounds like. Stay tuned. This is KCUR's Central Standard.
White people, my white American friends, I'm here to tell you something, all right? I like you.
That's comedian Russell Peters. He's Indian, and in this bit, he's talking about white people.
We have them so scared to notice anything of color that they're afraid to describe things accurately now. I was working at this comedy club. One of my black friends came down to hang out with me, and the doorman comes up and goes, "Hey, Russell, one of your friends came by." I go, "Was it a black guy?" "I don't know." "I didn't notice." "What do you mean you didn't notice?"
And he has another message for white people.
Okay to feel proud. It's not a bad thing. I mean, sometimes you get carried away and then you light crosses and put on pointy white hats, but that's, you know, you should draw the line somewhere before that. You know what I mean? You should.
We know what he means. The legacy of white supremacy does make it hard to express a strong interest in whiteness without raising a few eyebrows. But being white has to mean something. And if we don't talk about it, how do we know what that even is? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today I'm pleased to introduce David Roediger. He's a professor of history and American studies at KU, and he's one of the founders of the white studies discipline. Dave, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thanks, Gina. I'm delighted to be here.
Had you heard that bit from Russell Peters before, or any of his stuff for that matter?
I've heard some of his stuff. I don't remember those lines, but it's great.
What caught your attention there?
Well, I think the idea that whiteness goes so unnamed and can't speak its own name, and also the idea of colorblindness comes up in that clip, that white people like to claim that they don't see race even as they're kind of seeing race.
When you tell people that you are pursuing white studies, how do they tend to respond?
I always am kind of careful to say critical white studies or critical whiteness studies because it came about at a certain time when it was very much about critique. A lot of scholars since the 80s and African-American and other scholars of color before the 80s have made whiteness a problem. So they've just said, when did people in human history start to think of themselves as white? Why did they start to think of themselves as white? What are the political implications if a lot of people think that their primary identity is to be white? What are the moral, in James Baldwin's work, what are the moral implications of people thinking that they're white? So academically, that became a subfield in the late 80s and the early 90s. But Black people, in particular, Native people, had problems with whiteness before. And so they developed from, I think, probably folk tales forward, a kind of a critique of whiteness that people have been able to go back and draw upon.
Well, tell me a little bit about that critique of whiteness. Before this was a named field of study, what kind of critique existed of whiteness?
Well, for example, the greatest scholar in this vein was W.E.B. Du Bois, African-American activist, sociologist, historian. He was trying to think about World War I, and he said, the idea of personal whiteness, it's only about 250 years old. He was saying, first of all, that whiteness is not the natural category that people are bound to see black and white and regard people in those lines. And then he was trying to push back and think about under what circumstances, as Native lands were being taken and as African-American slavery was being instituted, under what circumstances did people come up with this, by the whole of human history, kind of crazy idea that it was important to identify oneself personally as white. He uses this interesting term, personal whiteness.
I'm picking up on a distinction between calling yourself white, seeing yourself white, and just a state of being white.
Yeah, I think what Du Bois was kind of pushing on in this idea of personal whiteness was that people notice skin color throughout human history. But all of a sudden, in this context of slavery and how you have a slave society and how you have a settler society, all of a sudden that became valuable. So whiteness becomes something that people could own or that could set them apart from people who were owned. So there's this sense in which whiteness as color is not really what we're talking about. What we're talking about is whiteness as power and as something that's of value.
Where did your personal interest in understanding whiteness come from? Our listeners can't see you. If I just saw you, I'd probably say you're a white guy, though I don't know what you would say about yourself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think I would identify as white. I grew up in southern Illinois in two places. The first place was a tiny little quarry town that I mostly went to school in that was all white and what people in the Midwest call a sundown town. That is, African-Americans were supposedly had to be out of town by sundown. Kansas has them. Missouri has them. Some sociologists say a majority of Midwestern towns in the 20th century were sundown towns. So I grew up in such a town where really the only experience of African-Americans was in popular culture and in how people imagined African-Americans. There were no African-Americans in town. I spent the summers, though, in this wonderful little town at the southern tip of Illinois called Caro, half black, half white, and with an incredible civil rights movement. This was the late 1960s. So I had this experience, and not only a civil rights movement, but a kind of a white power movement setting itself against that civil rights movement. So I was in these two extraordinarily racist places, one a sundown town and one half black and half white with an active struggle going on. So I think for me, it could never be that race was just kind of a simple thing. I knew white supremacy inside out, but it took such different forms that and then I became involved in the civil rights movement. And it was out of that that I found some space to think about studying it.
In these two different towns, especially I'm thinking about the town where there was an active civil rights movement,
right,
as well as a white supremacist movement. Is there an incident that you witnessed or something someone said to you that really turned on a light bulb for you in some way or just made you start asking questions?
Well, one thing that was true in Caro was that I was raised Catholic and made to go to church. And so I discovered that the little African-American mission church said Mass in about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. And the Irish church that my family went to took over an hour. So I decided I was going to that little church. And I think being in that church as the usually only white person in that church.
How old were you?
Oh, 12, 14. Old enough that my family would let me walk there and go to Mass there. And so to have that experience where whiteness couldn't be the natural thing, I think that a lot of times people think, well, I just am white. And if we just say American, we mean white American. So white is kind of the norm. In that situation, and then in the parts of my life where I've lived in West Africa, it's been a very healthy thing to be able to say, well, no, whiteness isn't the norm in the world. And we have to explain it and think about it just as we think about other identities.
So how do you explain it? How do you think about what white is?
Well, I think that, first of all, whiteness is property. I think that in the United States now, white wealth is about 12 times African-American wealth, probably about 10 times Latina and Latino wealth. So whiteness is an expectation that one should have some advantages in terms of property. Now, it's true that lots of white people are without property. So I think the word expectation becomes important, that when we think about poor whites, it's that idea that there ought to be advantage, that it ought to at some point pay off, that it hasn't yet. But if that's the case, then sometimes that's the only property you actually own, is that expectation, that hope that there'll be some kind of an advantage.
I think that it would be pretty easy to make a connection between the history of slavery and what you're describing as a property kind of association with whiteness by comparison with other races in America. But is it that simple, or is it more complex? Is it changing?
I think it's changing. And I think that civil rights law has made it more possible for whites to say, oh, my gosh, I don't have any advantages. It looks like there's affirmative action. I don't have any money. I think that that's said a lot. But then if you look at the figures, you still have these huge disparities in white wealth and black wealth. Now, the bottom two-thirds of white society doesn't have resources to speak of either, couldn't survive a major illness or a layoff. The problem, though, is that as long as whites don't examine their racial identity, as long as they think that both their advantages and their problems stem from being white, it's unlikely that those white poor and working people are going to be able to make much progress in solving their own problems either.
So you see part of this as white people entering into conversations about race in which they are participants, because that is interesting. It just does seem like a lot of the time when we talk about race, we are talking about everyone but white people.
Right, right. And in fact, most of the scholarship on this subject and a lot of the politics through U.S. history has talked about race as, quote, the Negro problem. And very early on, scholars like Du Bois and writers like James Baldwin insisted that there was also and mainly a white problem. And so once you think about it in that way, it becomes necessary not to just talk about race, but to talk about whiteness inside this conversation on race.
Other than property, what else is whiteness?
Well, I think whiteness is also has been and is a kind of an idea that white people are managers. In the slavery period, this was very clear that whites patrolled at night to see that slaves weren't walking around, weren't escaping. Whites served as overseers. Whites owned and managed other people. But also, the justification for taking Indian land, Native American land, was that whites knew how to manage the land better than Indians did. So you get this kind of broad sense that white people ought to have some kind of managerial ability and maybe ought to manage themselves. And then there's also this idea of whiteness that we talked about for a minute, of whiteness as a norm. Whiteness is just the baseline, just what the society is. And then there are these exceptions. There are these moments when you have to talk about other races. But whiteness has this particular ability to kind of not have to talk about itself.
Yeah, it reminds me of like the phrase ethnic food. The problem, you know, with that phrase right. being who decides what's just food, just normal food, and what is a less normal, more exotic kind of food we would call ethnic. If it seems like you're kind of describing a similar problem, that if white people are just Americans with no adjective in front of it, with no descriptor, then yeah, then that is a statement about a norm. How did that come to be?
Well, I think the interesting thing about it is how much whites accept this as just a natural fact. And I think it came along with the invention of whiteness out of slavery, that there was just this population that was made into a problem, which was the slave population. And the people who managed that problem didn't have to think of themselves as having a racial identity at all, but could say that they were citizens, that they were Americans, that they were all of those things that we all claim.
Is there something to being white that is outside of this kind of power dynamic? Because I think about that issue brought up in the comedy routine about, like, it's okay to be proud of yourselves, but when you're thinking only about a history of dominance, that piece of it sure is hard to be proud of.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess, you know, you can't disagree with comedy. Comedy's just comedy. But if it were politics, I would probably say that I disagree with that. I don't think that people need to be proud of being white. I think that there are all sorts of ethnicities that go into the making of a white population that are worth validating and worth thinking about. In the United States, until 1952, it was necessary to be white in almost all instances in order to be naturalized as a citizen. James Baldwin wrote in one short essay, he said, "Nobody sat around in Sweden bragging about how white they are." And what he was getting at was that whiteness is this mostly United States creation that groups people on the basis of their denying their ethnicity and not thinking about themselves as Irish and Italian and Jewish and all of these things that really are a culture and have, you talked about ethnic food, have their own food. There's not really white food. I would say that there's not a white culture, there's a white politics. And this makes it hard because sometimes young whites feel not only put upon by affirmative action or whatever, but they feel the absence of their own culture. They feel that there's a kind of an emptiness in white culture.
Yeah, just floating around as individuals without some kind of rootedness in something.
Yeah. I ask people, I taught at University of Missouri years ago, and I was guest lecturing in somebody else's class, and I said, "What would you put in an exhibit on white culture?" And there was just this long, strained silence about that question. And then somebody said, "Oh, Elvis." And everybody laughed that Elvis was so black in the origins of his music. But it was a revealing moment because people were striving to think about what it would look like to think about a white culture, but they were also feeling a kind of an emptiness around that.
But do you think that realization, especially on the part of white people, maybe could make us think differently about having symbols that we associate with other large racial groups? Like if you were to say something represents, some object represents all black people, I mean, black people come from many different countries,
right,
many different
right.
cultures.
Yeah, and more and more.
And that's kind of the problem there when you're talking about white people, too.
Yeah. Actually, part of the reason I raised that question in that class was that we were talking about the formation of a black cultural center and what was black culture. And I raised the question of whiteness and got this uneasy silence, which was productive in thinking about whiteness. But as you say, it's also productive in thinking about blackness. Are we too ready to say, oh, black people are this and this and this, and we could reduce African-American culture to these 8 or 10 symbols? Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
David, do you ever get students in classes exploring whiteness who are interested in white studies because of a misunderstanding about what it is, why you're doing it? Students who might actually gravitate toward white supremacy?
I was trained myself in African-American history, and I consider the critical study of whiteness to be a part of ethnic studies. So I've never had that happen. I have, when I taught at Missouri, I taught Southern history. And I had people who came into Southern history with Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirts and really wanted to explore their white, specifically white Southern heritage. But no, I've never had that problem.
How do you work with students who do want to explore their white Southern heritage?
Well, I think the key point is that that can only be done by thinking about the South as a whole, that you start with the Native South and then you talk about how there actually got to be the idea of whiteness and Africanness in that history. And so that if people want to know about themselves as white Southerners, it's incumbent on them to know the whole history of the South.
Let's talk with Debbie in Kansas City. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there. I just wanted to say, I think we as white people and with white advantage don't quite understand recent history. It's only been 40 or 50 years since Jim Crow and the laws written into where African Americans could live in Kansas City and stuff. And people say, well, why, you know, it's not my fault. I wasn't the one who enslaved them. Well, it goes deeper than that.
Well, I like the point very much about how recent some of these things are. I often think about sundown towns. By virtue of the town not admitting African Americans, all of those jobs were closed to African Americans. The big steel mill town just up the road was also a sundown town. Now, some blacks figured out how to commute and work in the steel mills, but it was an enormous disadvantage just geographically. Lots of sociology, lots of philosophy, history talks about white privilege. I've been trying to use the term in my own writing, white advantage, because I do think that if you look at a city like Kansas City, there are tons of white people who are so desperately involved in economic turmoil that it's really, really hard to say, oh, you're privileged to those people. I think it's a more precise thing to say that in certain ways, whites are advantaged in this society.
Do you think that the understanding that you're gaining of whiteness and the normative American concept, do you think that it has broader implications about understanding race?
Yeah. As I said, I think that lots of white Americans don't quite own that they're getting advantages. They would say, oh, no, you know, actually, it's either a level playing field or it's kind of tilted in the direction of affirmative action. But at the same time, Andrew Hacker, a white sociologist, posed this question, what would it take for whites to give up their whiteness? And it turns out this was about 15 years ago that Hacker's book came out, maybe 20. And at that time, people talked, the white informants that he had talked about wanting $2 million in compensation if they had to give up their whiteness. So I think there's both a sense that whiteness carries these property implications and privilege implications, but also a sense that those advantages are deniable and we don't have to talk about them.
Our time is up for today's show. You just heard a rebroadcast of our 2015 conversation about critical white studies. As our culture continues to grapple with what it means to be white and how to understand whiteness. You can listen back to either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, tune in for more in-depth discussions on KCUR's Central Standard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.